My guest at this time is Lawrence J. Haas. He served as communications director for Vice President Al Gore and a spokesman for the Clinton Administration Office of Management and Budget. He is now a columnist and a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. Larry's latest book is Harry and Arthur, Truman, Vandenberg, and the Partnership That Created the Free World. Larry, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Greg.
Obviously a tumultuous time right at the end of World War II. President Roosevelt had just died. Harry Truman had been vice president for a very little time. And, of course, Arthur Vandenberg is a Republican. So there's a lot of different challenges happening at the end of the war. The start of the UN, which you point to in the book, and how that all played out with the two of them negotiating, and then ultimately the fight with the Soviets over Europe through the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan and that sort of thing. So explain just how difficult this was for the meeting of the minds to come together here when, for those of us who study it from a historical perspective, just assumed a lot of these decisions were obvious.
Well, I think that's a very good place to start. You know, we Americans have this sense that there was an inevitability to America's rise to global leadership right after World War II, but there really was nothing inevitable about it at all. I mean, picture this, where World War II is ending. The Soviets were still technically an ally, but they were quickly turning into an adversary because it was clear they were breaking all of their promises to allow for free elections in Poland and across Eastern Europe. And here we've got a brand new president. He had been vice president for 82 days. President Roosevelt didn't share any of his foreign policy thinking with him. He didn't even know about the Manhattan Project that was underway to build the atomic bomb. So he's a brand new president, and the Soviets are increasingly threatening, and he's presiding over a country that basically was traditionally isolationist, that for 200 years had taken its foreign policy lessons back to George Washington's dictum in his farewell address of 1796 to steer clear of permanent alliances. And the United States had returned to isolationism after World War One, and here it's immediately in the aftermath of World War Two. The Soviets are making noise. Western Europe has been devastated by the war, and someone is going to need to stand to step up and ensure global security and defend freedom. And there's nothing inevitable about America stepping in to do this, and it takes two men. An enlightened, brand new Democratic president and an enlightened Senate Republican leader by the name of Arthur Vandenberg. And this is a remarkable story of two visionary leaders of different parties at a bitterly partisan time coming together in bipartisan fashion because they share a vision for what America must do at a very perilous time, or freedom is going to be threatened all over the world.
And you mentioned the politics. Of course, the Republicans did very well in the 1946 midterms, putting Truman on the defensive, but also giving him someone to go after as he ran for re-election in 1948. And a lot of folks assumed he was going to lose in 1948. All of that is the backdrop for what's going on with trying to stop the Soviet advance across Eastern Europe. So when you talk about the isolationist instinct of the United States, did both of these guys have more of an internationalist instinct because the aftermath of World War One turned out to be so unproductive, or did that come as a result of other factors?
You know, it's fascinating. Truman, from his early years, really was pretty consistent. He had a sense that America needed to play a strong role on the world stage, and he was one who wanted to contribute to it. He enlisted in World War One and actually spent some time overseas in 1918, in some perilous battles. And all through the 20s and the 30s and all through World War II, he was pretty consistent in thinking that America really couldn't be isolationist. It really did need to play a prominent role. Vandenberg took more of a journey. He had been an internationalist in his early years. He was the editor of the Grand Rapids Herald in Michigan, and he wrote editorials supporting Woodrow Wilson's sense of entering World War One to make the world safe for democracy. And he was consistent up through the 20s. However, when he became a senator, he got involved in an investigation of what prompted the United States to enter World War I in the first place, and he became convinced that somehow we shouldn't have done it, that this was all a plot by bankers and weapons makers to make money and convince the United States to get involved in a war that it didn't need. And in the late 1930s, interestingly enough, he was one of America's most prominent isolationists. And he, in fact, woke up. He had a revelation after Pearl Harbor that, you know what, the United States couldn't be isolationist anymore. It couldn't wall itself off because, if nothing else, than the fact that weapons are becoming so sophisticated that there's no such thing as safety by having an ocean to the right and an ocean to the left, or an ocean to the east and an ocean to the west, that we needed to play a role because otherwise we would be increasingly vulnerable. So with Truman, it was consistency, and with Vandenberg, it was more of an intellectual journey. But they wound up in the same place as World War II was coming to an end and as Truman was taking over for Roosevelt.
We're talking with Larry Haas. The book is Harry and Arthur. And Larry, when it comes to foreign aid now, there's factions in both parties, honestly, that think that we do too much. We try to be the world's policeman. We can't be everywhere. Not that they would necessarily classify themselves as isolationists, but they think that we're spending too many of our resources abroad when we have many challenges at home. Why? And they also point out that a lot of times foreign aid seems to just go down a giant hole and doesn't necessarily yield the results we want. The Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, very different. Why did those work so well?
First of all, the times were, of course, different, and there was a certain kind of immediacy to the challenge that we had in the late 1940s. And, you know, Americans, I must say, throughout our history, we do tend to step up when crises are before us, and we do tend to find the leaders that we need, whether it's Washington with the founding of the country, or it's Lincoln with the Civil War, or it's Roosevelt with the Great Depression and World War II, or in this case, it's Truman and Vandenberg with the Soviet threat. So part of it was really the dire nature of the challenge. But I will say something else, which is that you had asked about foreign aid. You know, foreign aid in the form back then of the Marshall Plan was really only one element of this revolutionary new foreign policy that Truman and Vandenberg created. And today, it is really only one element of a broad foreign policy. We don't really spend as much on foreign aid as people think we do. It's a tiny portion of the U.S. budget. But more importantly, it's really a tiny portion of the U.S. role in the world. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is because, you know, historians are inspired to write about history based on current events. And as you mentioned, we Americans have been doubting what we can do around the world in recent years. We've been rethinking our global role. It's been led by President Obama, who focuses much more on what he calls nation building at home. But if you believe the polls, we Americans have become a bit more isolationist and less interested in the world and more fearful that we can no longer afford our global role. But I would suggest to people, and I hope that they will read Harry and Arthur, because the lesson is that there's no one waiting in the wings to defend freedom. You know, we took over from the British right after World War II. They had been the traditional power that defended freedom around the world. We took over in the late 1940s. If we step back, there is no great power in the West to defend freedom. And there are great threats to freedom out there right now. And if not us, then who? And that's the main question that I'm trying to raise for people to ponder as they read about the great accomplishments of Harry Truman and Arthur Vandenberg.
And it's very much worth your time. Again, the book is Harry and Arthur. And Larry, you mentioned, of course, that these gentlemen back in the 40s were very much part of their political parties, very much fierce in their desire to win elections and to score political points along the way. Yet at the same point, when it came to combating communism and the U.S. role in the world, even if they didn't have identical positions, they were largely in the same ballpark. And I think it's safe to say that for a number of decades afterwards, at least maybe to the early 60s, that the parties, for the most part, seemed to have the same instincts, although they had differences in significant ways. Now it seems like we just have these giant chasms about what the U.S. role in the world is. You've done battle with your own party over the Iran nuclear deal, for example, and other priorities along the way, the Obama opening up relations with Cuba and so forth, just huge divides between the two parties. So can we get back to this point where, even though there's fierce political differences, there's at least instincts about where America's leadership role needs to be pointing?
Yeah, so let me make a few points. I think you lay it out pretty well. We had the benefit, to the extent that I use the term ironically, we had the benefit of the Cold War in the sense that there was broad consensus in America that the Soviets, aggressive Soviet communism, was in fact the enemy. So the Cold War helped keep us united, even with our differences between the parties, keep us united for about half a century. Now, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we have seen the rise and fall of different doctrines and different threats, but no unifying factor like Soviet communism was for half a century. Having said that, I'm actually a bit optimistic about the future, and I'll tell you why. We have seen an experiment in recent years, in a sense, an American retreat. The president spending the last 7 years reducing the American footprint around the world, in particular in the greater Middle East, but not only there, in an effort to share global burdens with not only allies but adversaries. I think that there is growing recognition that American retreat does not lead to a safer world. It leads to a more dangerous world. We face right now probably the greatest combination of threats to U.S. national security that we have faced since the time of Truman and Vandenberg. So as we look to the future and you ask the question, can we get back to this consensus? I actually think we are beginning to get back to this consensus because people have seen what we've tried in recent years. And if you believe the polls, they are coming to a recognition that we need to be stronger than we've been acting in recent years. So I'm optimistic as I look to the future, but I will say this. It's not going to be easy because we have a multiplicity of threats as opposed to that one unifying threat that we had in the Cold War that really helped to galvanize people on both sides of the aisle.
Where do you think that middle ground can be found? Just in general, I guess, in foreign policy, as you mentioned, there's several threats out there, but whether it's the threat of radical Islam or whether it's communist North Korea or anything else that poses some sort of existential threat.
Well, I think we're becoming a little bit more comfortable in recognizing that radical Islam, and I don't mean Islam in general, but I do mean radical Islam, and there's nothing wrong with talking about it that way, is a political and a militant movement, and that it's a global movement, and that it threatens free people, not just in the Middle East, not just in Europe, but here in the United States. So that's one thing for sure. Number two, I think there's great controversy about whether it was wise to cut this nuclear deal with Iran and provide them with all of this sanctions relief, billions and billions of dollars to the world's greatest state sponsor of terrorism. And number three, there is a sense of fear, I believe, about the rise of authoritarian powers, great powers around the world, whether it's China in the Pacific or it's Russia near Europe. So while there's not one unifying threat, I think there are three or four very prominent threats that are beginning to galvanize people toward a return to a more robust U.S. role around the world to protect itself, to protect its allies, and to defend freedom.
Larry, we'll have to call time there. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me, and I hope everybody reads Harry and Arthur.
Larry Haas is the author of Harry and Arthur, Truman, Vandenberg, and the Partnership That Created the Free World. He is a former communications director for Vice President Al Gore. He's now a columnist and a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.